Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and hosted by Pearson Crutcher and Jay Healy. The Society of Entrepreneurs is a membership organization founded to promote entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to Memphis business owners.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. When you think of advertising in Memphis, the first name you certainly think of is John Malmo.
John is a great leader in the industry, and he shares so many stories about how he's helped both local and national firms build their brands over time.
We hope that you will enjoy John's many words of wisdom as we discuss his entrepreneurial journey. Good afternoon. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. We're so happy today to have John Malmo, the infamous John Malmo, with us for this interview. So, John, thank you so much for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
Got lots of great things that I want to talk to you about because I've heard some of your wonderful stories.
Okay.
First thing I want to do is make a plug for your wonderful book, When I Call It When Monkey Is King, but what's the main whole title of your book?
When There Is No Tiger on the Mountain, Monkey is King.
All right. And before this interview is over, I want you to tell the story about how you got the name of that book. Did you grow up in Memphis? Are you a native Memphian?
Born in Milwaukee, moved here when I was four.
All right. And then tell us a little bit about growing up. What's John Malmo's story?
Went to training school and then to Central and then to Sewanee. And then to Ole Miss, and then to the Army, and then to Rhodes for a semester to get some quality points, and then to Boston University and graduated and came home.
Very good. And what would you get your degree in?
In English and communications.
So did you always know that you wanted to start an advertising firm?
No.
What was your first job after college?
When I got out of the Army and went to Boston, I worked midnight to 8 on a newspaper.
Okay.
On Suburban Daily in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is on the South Shore of Boston. And I worked midnight to 8 and went to school during the day.
Wow. When did you sleep? Not much.
On the weekends.
Yeah. Wow. So you didn't always know you wanted to start an advertising firm. Can you tell us how it all started?
Well, I wanted to be an editor of editor of the New York Times. So I started out in the newspaper business, and I worked for the Quincy Patriot Ledger, and I worked off and on for the Commercial Appeal for 3 or 4 different spurts of, all told, maybe 3 years. Then I really wanted to get into PR. I didn't know much about advertising. And I went to work for a guy named John Claggern, who had a little PR firm, worked for him for a year. Then he had to let me go because he didn't have enough business. And so I went to work for Jim Incorporated, which was a manufacturer of housewares with a factory in Byhalia. And I was there for, I can't remember how long I was there, but I was there for couple of years or so, and a guy from an ad agency in Memphis came in to call on me. I was the marketing director for the company, and he wanted to be our advertising agency. And I had a pegboard behind my chair in my office that had a sample of each of our products hanging on a pegboard. And he looked past me when he sat down, and he said, "Oh, is that what you make?" And I went home and I told my wife, if that's the example of a Memphis advertising agency that a guy makes a new business call on somebody and doesn't have the faintest idea what business they're in until he gets in my office, then we need a new agency. So I opened mine.
I love that. So, of course, you started Archer Malmo. Or was it, is that how it started?
No, I was John Malmo Advertising for 25 years.
Okay.
And then I sold John Malmo Advertising to Ward Archer, Jr.
And that advertising firm got to be pretty big. How many people did you end up having?
When I sold John Malmo Advertising, we had 65 people. Archer Malmo, and that was, gosh, that was 30 years ago that I sold it, and we became Archer Malmo. And now, I guess there are probably 100 and maybe 20 people in the Memphis office and maybe 20 people in the Austin, Texas office.
Wow, that's awesome. It's gotten to be a pretty big
one. And they've done very well.
How long were you involved with the company from start to finish?
After I sold to Ward, I stayed active for 15 or 20 years, but I was not part of management. Owned no stock, was responsible for nothing except a few small accounts of my own that I felt close to that I wanted to continue to work on.
And otherwise just told everybody what you thought all the time, right?
If I was asked.
It's one of the benefits about being around with John is yes. That you know exactly where you stand, right?
Yep.
I like that a lot. Well, tell me a little bit about the people that you hired to work for Archer Malmo. How did you find and retain and get the most talented people there?
Well, I always tried to hire somebody who I thought was better than I was. As far as art direction, that was pretty easy because I was never an art director. But I tried to hire the best people I could hire. And I made the mistake in the early years by hiring people I could afford and then ended up getting rid of them and having to go out and pay a lot more. And the biggest jump I made was finding a gal in New York called Mitzi Morris who didn't do anything but hunt for creative people. And I got two art directors and a writer from her in one fell swoop. And that was very helpful. It wasn't too hard to hire people that I thought were better than I was because I was looking for people for specific spots.
Because I don't really understand how the whole advertising thing works. And I know that you're such an idea man. I mean, you've got such great ideas. Whenever I talk to you and you're talking to another business, you can always bring it right to the point that needs to be for those businesses. How do you manage people that you're trying to get to be creative underneath you? Does that make sense?
I don't know as I ever tried to manage anybody to be creative. I'm not really sure what creative means. I think fresh may be a better word. And people who think like children, if I were getting ready to hire people today, I might go and see if I could find any adults on a playground and I'd hire them. Because when people are no longer childlike and they become too sophisticated, then they're not very fresh anymore. And you can't expect freshness out of them.
Interesting. So when you were hiring people in the past, how did you assess that? How did you measure that?
Well, if it was an account person, I wanted account people who didn't come from other agencies. I wanted account people that came from the client side of the business because only then would they understand really what it's like to be a client and the problems that they face. Because agency people have a way of getting together and talking about the stupid client wouldn't do this or insisted on that. And if you haven't had any experience as a client and know the pressures that an advertising manager or marketing director or VP of sales works under, then you aren't going to be very helpful. So you need to understand their pressures and be a help to them.
That's insightful. Is there anything that you applied to other roles specifically like that?
As far as creative people, again, fresh people, you spend a little time with them. Pay attention to the conversation, what they think about, the way they respond to what's happening around them and what they say. And of course, if there's somebody who is experienced, and I almost never hired fresh college graduates, I'd rather somebody else train them. But if they had any experience at all, then they had a book of their work. And if you could find out what percentage of their book they actually were responsible for, because too often the book included some work by other people.
So you said that you saw this opportunity and you just like jumped on it of starting a firm.
Yeah, I borrowed $2,500 from the National Bank of Commerce. Bobby Snowden let me have some office space on top of the B&S Delicatessen on 52 South 2nd Street, which then was the B&S Delicatessen. Later was Jim's Place for a while, and then the German restaurant. But I went up there, and I had a card table that had been a wedding present from somebody, and there was an office supply store around the corner, and I went and borrowed a chair from him and said I'd buy my office supplies from him if he'd lend me a chair. And that's where I started.
And how many people did you hire out of the gate, or none?
I hired one. I hired my secretary from E.L. Bruce. I had been at E.L. Bruce for 5 years before I went to Jim. Actually, I'd forgotten that. When I got out of the newspaper, I went to E.L. Bruce.
Who became your first client or your first best client?
My first client was a guy I was moonlighting for while I was still employed. He was in Starkville, Mississippi. We had been Boy Scouts together in Memphis, and he had ended up at Mississippi State, and then with another friend started a furniture factory, and then that expanded, and they ended up buying a famous old clock company from Cincinnati, and then they got into the fishing motor business. I was moonlighting for them, and then when I went into business, they were my first client.
You have lots of great stories for ad campaigns that you've worked on that people would know very clearly in the city of Memphis. Can you share some of those stories?
If you're in the advertising business, what you want to do is you want to build a strong brand, or if you're representing a strong brand, you want to build it stronger. You want it to get a bigger market share. So if you're just doing job shop work, you know, onesies and twosies for somebody, that's fine. And you can do good work. You can do good work that way. I mean, you can do good work regardless what you're working on. And you can make a living. But if you really, you know, if you want to grow and grow the agency and make more opportunity for your employees, then you have to get into the brand business. And you've got to build that brand. If it doesn't keep building, like Angel Food Ice Cream, going way back, nobody knows what it is anymore because it's out of business. But when we started working for them, they had a 10% market share. When they sold it, they had a 40% market share.
What did you do to get that?
It's kind of complicated, but primarily what we discovered was that the big ice cream brands only advertised in the summer. And so we advertised in the winter.
People eat ice cream all year round. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We started out we ran one TV spot a week on the Channel 5 10 o'clock news. And then as we grew, we ran two spots a week. And then I think we ended up five spots a week on one channel. And then we did the same thing on the second channel. And we ran the same commercial for 25 years.
It must have been a good one.
It was.
some real staying power.
We made a very, very strong commercial that differentiated the brand. We shot it in Dallas and paid a lot of money then for it. But the client understood that if he was going to be the premium ice cream, he couldn't look like we'd made a TV spot in the garage.
True.
So he paid for it, but we kept running it and running it and running it and running it.
I know there's another ad that you did that's one of my favorites, and I don't want to say it because I want you to tell the story without me giving it away, but it has something to do with your yards.
The yards. Yards. Oh, let me kill your weeds. Well, I met Kenny, who owns Herba Systems, and that's a business that has a high turnover. They lose about 50. All companies, all green up your yard companies lose about half of their customers in the fall because people say they don't need it anymore or they're unhappy because everybody was promising them to have a gorgeous green lawn and people assumed they meant this summer. And that's impossible. I mean, it takes at least one growing season. First of all, you have to kill the weeds. Then you have to grow the grass to be pretty. So you're not going to have a really beautiful lawn unless you're already starting with a beautiful lawn in less than a couple of years. And so I suggested to Kenny that we say, let us kill your weeds instead of saying we're going to have a beautiful lawn because instead of you being unhappy in the fall that you don't have a beautiful green lawn, you know damn well we killed your weeds. That's easy to identify. And you can do that in about 30 days.
Yeah. And that's still the theme of the company.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it still is fundamentally the same. I mean, the issue hadn't changed. Yeah. Before you grow a beautiful lawn, you have to kill the weeds.
And it always seems like he's having fun saying that.
Yeah. And people then can look in the fall and say, he did what he promised to do. He didn't promise to give you a gorgeous green lawn. Now, he will the second year.
And, you know, I think that that goes to customer service, which is, I know, something that you really care passionately about and giving. And you have a very simple recipe for giving good customer service, but most people don't adopt it. But can you go into some of that? How do you give good customer service?
Well, the definition of customer service is communications. Talking to your customer and making it easy for the customer to talk to you. If you do that, then you're giving great customer service. If you don't, it doesn't make any difference what else you're doing. You're going to lose the business ultimately because they can't communicate with you. I can't get in touch with them. I call them and can't get them on the telephone. Their website is not adequate. They don't respond to it. So, you know, people say, well, we give great service because we ship on time, or we give great service because we have all the colors we advertise, or we give great service because we ship it overnight. That's all part of the product. It's part of the sale that you told them you were going to do that, and you did it, so that was the product. But service becomes when they want to call you and say, you shipped the wrong color. I haven't gotten it yet. Is it easy? Do you make it easy? And if you don't, you have rotten service. And if you do, you have great customer service. Customers want to be able to communicate with you. And that gets harder and harder and harder. Otherwise, why would anybody advertise today that if you call us, a real person's going to answer? I mean, imagine that. People take their time and their money to advertise that.
True.
That it's so unusual that you get a real person.
But that is a true benefit. I mean, it's enough to make you want to use that business if you know you're going to actually be able to talk to somebody for sure.
Communications.
What's the favorite account that you ever worked on?
Oh, my goodness.
I know we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by them not being your favorite, but what's the one that you feel like you really made an impact?
We felt we made an impact on dozens.
Of course, of course.
And generally, we could, statistically, we could prove that we had. I've never given 60 seconds thought to a favorite account. I had so many favorite accounts. The most favorite account was always the new account because you had to learn about the account. Generally, we knew the category or we wouldn't go after an account. Because to get a new account, a big asset is to be very knowledgeable in that category.
So maybe it's not your favorite, but what's an example of a client that you serve where you thought it was a great case study for what Arthur Malmo would do?
Our job was to solve problems. And every company has problems. Every brand has problems. And quite often, brands are using advertising to try to solve a non-advertising problem. I mean, if the problem is customer service, if the problem is delivery, if the problem is too much choice or too little choice, or that the product doesn't hold up. These are problems you can't solve with advertising. And if you're advertising with a big weakness, you're just wasting your money because you're going to kill the product quicker the more you get out there. So you have to fix the problems back home before you start advertising.
So would that be something you worked with a lot, where
yes,
people wanted you to do an ad and instead you helped them fix their problem?
Absolutely. Okay. We may not advertise for 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And the interesting thing was that so often the salesman in the field really knew what the company was making. And the people who, back at the home office, frequently, they didn't know as well what the product was and how it was used as much as the salesman did. That first client I had, the furniture client, he had his first sales meeting, and he only had about 5 reps at that time. And we were playing poker, and it was about 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and there was a fellow named Will Roach from Charlotte. And I said, "Will, when you take this junk into a furniture store, what do you tell them?" And the client was making exposed wood arm furniture, wood backs with loose cushions. And he said, "I tell them I got the hottest line of family room furniture in America." And I said, "Family room? Nobody ever. What's family room furniture?" And he said, "Well, nobody's going to put this in their living room. And because the cushions are loose, you can throw them away. You can take the covers off and you can wash them and whatever the kids spill on them, and the old man can stick his feet on the arms and it's solid oak and they're going to last." So at that sales meeting we changed the name of the company from Early American by Howard to Howard Family Room Furniture. And we were the only people in America saying, "We make family room furniture," and there were 50,000 new family rooms being built every year.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
But that came from a salesman.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the point is nobody's going to have all the great ideas. If you have a couple of great ideas a year, that's pretty good. But what is really valuable is to be able to identify the good ideas when you hear them.
Would you say that was your superpower?
Well, I don't have a superpower, but I say it certainly is an asset.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you look back, if you started the company with a folding table above a deli, and then decades later, you're a well-established advertising PR firm with hundreds of employees, what would you say was attributable to that success?
Successful clients. If we didn't build a client's business, we'd lose it. Or the biggest problem we had was getting clients so successful that they attracted national agencies, and the agencies from Chicago and New York came down and tried to take them away. And they'd never heard of the companies until we started. They didn't know what Hunter Fan was until we started making fans again.
Tell us about that campaign.
Well, I was sitting in my office on a Friday afternoon, and the marketing director at Hunter called me, and he said, "We're getting ready to shut the factory," because there was a building recession at the time, and they made baseboard heaters, electric baseboard heaters. And so I said, well, I'll stop by and we'll talk about it. And so I left the office a little early, stopped by Hunter on the way home. And I was sitting there thumbing through the catalog while we were talking, and I saw the old Hunter ceiling fan, which I was very familiar with because we had them in our house when I was growing up. And I looked at it and I said, I've forgotten his name now because we lived through six or seven marketing directors. But I said, do you guys still make these? And he said, yeah. He said, we got an old guy in the back, about 65 or 70 years old. And we have a customer in New York who works for House Beautiful magazine. And she runs a little Shopper's Place ad in the magazine selling these old ceiling fans. And I said, well, my recommendation is to shut down the heating line and freshen the ceiling fan line and do nothing but make ceiling fans. And then we devised a way to go into five markets with distributors and go out to 20 dealers in each of those five markets with guaranteed sale purchases, and then running small ads in those markets, Miami, Atlanta, Memphis, Dallas, and Phoenix, I think. We ran a little ad about that big in the paper. It said, old-time ceiling fans are back to $19.95 or whatever, with the retail price in it. 2 years later, the president mentioned to me that he came into work that week and there was a retailer from probably Miami sitting on the front doorstep with a cashier's check for $2 million to try to buy ceiling fans. They were so far back ordered.
Wow. How did you know that heating units weren't where they should be, but fans were, because we were in Memphis and it was hot?
Well, it was in the middle of the energy crunch. I think Carter was president, and there had been a little item in Time magazine that he had ordered. It was summer, and he had ordered them to not run the thermostats below 72, and everybody was opening the windows, and the mice were coming in to the Capitol. Because the windows were open. So we ran a full page in the Washington Post saying, keep cool for peanuts.
Oh, okay.
And we got a GSA number, and they sold a lot of fans to the government. And it was an energy crunch, and people were not running their air conditioners as much, and a ceiling fan made a whole lot of sense.
Maximizing opportunity, huh? So as far as running the business goes, did you have any mentors along the way that helped you?
Oh, I wish I had. No, I really didn't. And I was a pretty rotten agency president. I should have hired a president long before I did.
Uh-huh. So did you wind up delegating sort of executive roles along the way?
No, I tried to do it myself.
Yeah.
And didn't do a very good job of it. Ward Archer was a lot smarter than I was after I sold John Malmo Advertising to Ward Archer and Associates. It didn't take Ward long to hire a president who's done a great job of building the agency, certainly better than I could have done, and I know Ward would probably say better than he could have done it also.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear, because businesses need leadership, and if you're good at some things and not good at that, you need to get somebody else to step in, right?
Well, that's what you keep hearing about, people that are entrepreneurs that aren't good managers and that they need to know when to hire somebody else.
The more time you spend on your strength, probably more successful you'll be, and the less time you spend on the areas in which you're weaker.
You know, another story that I know is about a local company that you really helped when a woman came to you when she'd just gotten some businesses. Can you share a little bit about that story?
Oh, the Pugh's Flowers, Mrs. Pugh, into my office, I can't remember how many years ago, but her husband, they had just bought 3 flower shops. And then he died very young. And she had 3 little boys. And they were with her. And she wasn't sure what she should do. So we make a long story short, we got rid of the names of the flower shops that they had bought, and we put Pugh's name on all 3 of them. And then we created a skunk character called Pewy, and we started advertising on television, and no other florist was advertising on television at that time. And the boys were coming along. She worked hard, and the boys worked hard, and they became dominant.
I remember listening to John talk, and he was saying that if your last name is Pugh, you need to own a flower shop. Exactly. So talk about community service. I know that you give back a lot in the community, and I know that you have one organization that's especially near and dear to your heart. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. If you have any business success in a city like Memphis, you're going to be asked to be on a lot of nonprofit boards. And when it came time for me to be asked to be on a lot of nonprofit boards, I wasn't very smart, and I just didn't want to turn people down. And all of a sudden, I found myself on a half a dozen nonprofit boards and realized before long that I wasn't contributing anything to any of the boards. I wasn't rich enough to give them a lot of money, and I didn't have the time to give them all a lot of time. So I resigned from all 6 and said, I'm through with board work. And then a close friend of mine said, I happen to know that you've sold the company and you have gotten off of all these boards. I need you on one board. And I went over and looked at William R. Moore College, and I knew about it. I had known about William R. Moore all my life. And so I said, that interests me. And we had a small board. There was a small board at the time, 5-member board. And so I said, well, you know, maybe if I get on that board and don't split my time with anything else, that I can help and that I can make an impact. And we did. The board, we all worked very hard together, and we started advertising the college. We shortened the name for promotional purposes to More Tech, simply because television time was too expensive to say William R. Moore College of Technology. And we found a great guy to be president, and the college has just boomed ever since. And I recommend that to anybody, that if you spread yourself across several boards, you're not going to accomplish much. But if you stick with 1, maybe 2 at the most, and really spend a lot of time and effort, you really can make a difference.
How long have you been involved with More Tech?
20, 25 years.
Yeah. How would you describe it to somebody as far as what they do and how they do it?
Well, More Tech is a huge success. There are 2 other schools in the United States like More Tech that are private, nonprofit. I mean, we graduate about 80 to 85% of the students who enter the school. That's an extraordinary high percentage. And of our graduates, 95 to 96% get a job in their field when they graduate. And they get good jobs. That is the measure to me of a school.
And More Tech's focus on training or education is what?
Well, there are 7 programs, from automobile technology to welding, plumbing, electricity, HVAC. It's just a fantastic school. No other school like it does as well as More Tech does. As a school in St. Louis, it's a little bigger than we are, but it's a remarkable place, and it's very well funded, thanks to president who's done a great job of raising money.
But when you got on that board, it wasn't, the school wasn't in great shape, and you helped to right the ship. How did you go about that?
Well, yeah, we'd gotten down under 100 students, and things were in pretty bad shape. We'd had a declining enrollment for 10 straight years, I think it was. And it was a situation where everybody in town knew about William R. Moore. If you asked them, have you ever heard of William R. Moore? Almost everybody would say, yeah, I've heard of that. But if you asked somebody, name a technical or a vocational college, they couldn't name William R. Moore. So we had aided awareness, but we didn't have any unaided awareness. So I was able to get the board to agree to spend a couple of $100,000 of our $1 million endowment at that time. And we invested it in advertising, and it turned, the enrollment turned around almost immediately and has grown consistently ever since then. And it, now, I suspect if you ask people in town to name a vocational college, a technical college, I'd be surprised if we didn't have at least 50% unaided awareness.
Because we need an HVAC worker, a person that can fix my HVAC and not another stinking lawyer, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I have a computation where I can show you that a guy who graduates from Moore Tech in plumbing or who graduates from in HVAC, whatever, has a better opportunity to create wealth than a person who goes, just say, to UT Knoxville for 4 years and goes into the bank training program. And you see him driving around in trucks. What's the fellow's name? Conroy on television?
Conway.
Conway, is that it every night?
Yes. Yeah. They're doing good, aren't they?
I suspect he's glad he's not a banker.
I bet you're right.
No reflection on banking.
No, but we do know when we've all needed somebody at our house, so whether it was a plumber or HVAC or something, we want them to be able to, and we want them to answer our phone call too, right, John? We want to be able to communicate with them.
Client communications.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what excites you about Memphis these days?
That's a good question. I think we've had pretty good government for the last few terms. I think that the city council has measured itself pretty well in its decisions, and I think that the last couple of mayors have done a good job. Memphis has never been an Atlanta or a Nashville that just had a huge spurt. It's always been much more like a turtle, and it grows slowly, kind of two steps forward and one step back. But it's a good, solid market. Nashville, there was no way they could lose. I mean, every state capital has had enormous growth because there's no business has grown faster in the United States than government in my lifetime. And if you're a state capital, I mean, all of the downtown and the capital area in Nashville was rebuilt a number of years ago with state taxes. I mean, they didn't offer the same kind of money to rebuild downtown Memphis or the government center here. But no, I think, you know, FedEx has just been such a huge impact and continued the entrepreneurial growth in Memphis. Because Memphis, you know, I mean, if you go back to the Dobbs brothers and the first airline catering company, I mean, I can remember getting on a DC-3 at Memphis and having them hand me a box with a sandwich and an apple. And that was the first airline catering company.
I kind of miss that.
You can get some pretzels now, Jay.
And, you know, I gather that it's continuing. And what's really good, I think, is how many young women. I mean, you had me speaking with a group of 15 young entrepreneurs last week or week before last, And all but two of them were young women. And they appear to be successful. I think that's terrific. And that's a great advantage of Memphis, because Memphis is not as expensive as other markets this size and larger. And it's, I think, much easier to go into business for yourself in Memphis.
Did that play a significant role for you and your company?
Oh, well, I told you I borrowed $2,500.
Yeah. Easy to get started, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And easy to get clients, too? Because sometimes those Chicago, New York advertising firms are not focusing on the businesses here.
I mean, the big national firms, they're not interested in anything that's not a national account. The national accounts that we had, you know, at one time we had Terminix and we had Hunter Fan and we had Bruce Flooring and we had virtually every national account in town except FedEx. But there were also good local accounts. We had First Tennessee Bank when it was First National and then changed the name across the state, you know, to First Tennessee. And that was a big account.
You know, one of the things that we talked about in the very beginning of this talk was your book. And I love to read, and I think your book is one of the best ever because it is a compilation of articles that you wrote for the Commercial Appeal, so you can read them in a few minutes anyway. So you get a great information. What are some books that you've really learned a lot from? Do you have any recommendations?
Rudy Flesch's books, Readable Writing. There were two guys, real smart guys named Al Rees and Jack Trout, who created the positioning, the idea of positioning a brand, which really wasn't a fresh idea. It was a fresh name. There'd been a guy, Rosser Reeves, back 30 years before that. He called it something different, but he had come up with the idea. But Al and Jack, they wrote about market positioning. And when I first read the article in Advertising Age, I just thought it was brilliant. I had not seen that. And I looked at it and I said, well, you know, that's what we've been doing, but we just didn't know what to call it. And I said, I need to talk to these guys. So I went to New York and spent the night. And then the next day I spent 4 or 5 hours with Trout and Reese. And they were very accommodating and sat and talked to me, and I learned a tremendous amount from them and came back. And then I had a label for what we were doing.
Exactly.
So, Pearson, John's got a unique experience of an entrepreneur who's worked with tons of entrepreneurs. I think we need to ask him the question.
Yes, ask them.
Do you think that entrepreneurs are born or taught?
Probably not born, but I don't know that I'd say taught. What makes an entrepreneur is willingness to accept risk. If you don't accept risk, you're not an entrepreneur. And I think there can be a period when somebody is an entrepreneur or is likely to become an entrepreneur that might not 5 or 10 years later.
Because they don't want that risk at a different point in their life.
Right, or feel that they can't gamble. When I got married, I remember my wife's father, she told me, she said, he asked her, what does John do? And she said, well, he doesn't have a job right now, but he says he's going to get one. And you know, that was a scary time.
So are there any specific traits that you saw for successful entrepreneurs? So being able to take risks, certainly one of them.
Absolutely self-starter.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I mean, if you have to have direction, you're no entrepreneur.
John, one of the things that we talked about is the book, Monkey is King. Tell me what that means.
We had a large client called Universal Furniture that was headquartered in the United States in California, but the ownership was in Singapore and Taiwan. And I was on a trip to the Far East and was sitting in the office of the founder of the company. The company was unique because he didn't know anything about manufacturing furniture, but he knew there was a need in Singapore. Somebody was getting ready to build a new hotel. And so he put in a bid for the furniture because he knew that there was a lot of dormant rubberwood plantations that the timber rights could be bought for literally nothing, because once a rubber tree quit producing rubber, they didn't think it had any value. Could you make furniture out of it? It turned out to be a great wood for making furniture. So he bought the timber rights. Then he put factories to cut the timber right in the middle of the plantations. Then right next to that, he built factories to manufacture parts and pre-finish them and then ship them to the United States and assemble them in big consumer markets. He did the same thing in Europe, and it was hugely successful. I mean, within about 3 years, they were the largest manufacturer of case goods in the world. And I asked him, his name was Larry Moe, and I said, Larry, why did you happen to go into the furniture business of all the things you could have done? And he said, there is old Chinese expression that when on the mountain there is no tiger, monkey is king. And when we started, there was no large international furniture manufacturer. The business was dominated by small factories, mostly in the United States. And that was true. So no tiger. Larry fancied himself as the monkey. And he built brand new factories. He had access to money. And everybody in the United States was still making furniture in factories that were 50 and 100 years old.
So it's about finding the opportunity and pouncing on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And being able to identify. I mean, he really gave it a lot of thought, looking for something to get into and the ability to match the rubber wood just sitting there with no use.
That's incredible, isn't it? It's always so much fun to be with you, John. I mean, every time I was thinking about our conversation the other day that when you spoke to the Insights Group, thank you very much again for doing that for us. And when you started telling the story about Let Me Kill Your Weeds, and I was like, of course that's a John Malmo ad. I mean, of course. Why would I have not watched that ad on TV and known that was you? Because you just cut to the chase, and it's awesome to be around.
Right, like people talk.
Best advice you ever got, wasn't it?
Yep. It's mighty good.
Sure is. Well, this has been a lot of fun, so thank you so much.
Glad I could help.
Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed our conversation with John Malmo. If you want to hear more about John and some of the books he's written, you can find information in our show notes.